whether it's a domestic criminal case or an international criminal case, is just look around a courtroom and say, where are the women? When something's being negotiated, are the women at the table? Are the women's issues being discussed? Perhaps the other message that I like to leave, as well as practical optimism, practical reality of having women involved in these types of processes.
The recent war in Ukraine has nearly hit the year-long mark. Since the initial invasion in February 2022, discussions about accountability and justice for Ukrainians have been widespread. In this episode, we will be discussing and evaluating the different possible avenues to achieving this, and whether Russian military leaders would be better dealt with by the international community, the Ukrainian judiciary, or a combination of the two. These possibilities will be explored alongside an assessment of international criminal and humanitarian law's capacity and ability to prosecute such individuals. From the University of Cambridge and the Center of Governance and Human Rights, my name is Nima Jayasinghe, and I'm your host for this episode of Declarations. I also have with me in the studio Charlotte Duthie as panelist. She is a graduating law student at Downing College at the University of Cambridge. As our special guest today, we have Felicity Gerry. Felicity is an experienced international barrister and professor of legal practice, admitted in England, Wales, and Victoria, Australia. She has extensive experience in human rights cases and is admitted to the list of counsel for the International Criminal Court, currently working on the Al-Hassan trial. Felicity has advised on death penalty matters in Indonesia and has extensive criminal defense trial and appellate experience, as well as teaching complex issues in war crimes and human trafficking. Most recently, advocating for child soldier victim rights in an amicus curiae brief at the International Criminal Court in the Ogwell Appeal. Thank you so much, Felicity, for joining us today. It is an honour to have you with us.
That's very kind of you. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So to get the ball rolling for the topic at hand today, I was wondering if you could give us and the listeners a quick brief explanation of what are the current events taking fold in the field and the landscape when it comes to war crimes in Ukraine.
Okay, well, as far as I understand it, there are some records now that are being considered in relation to the amount of war crimes being recorded. I've recently read some material that says that the Prosecutor General's Office of the Ukraine has officially registered 71,321 war crimes and crimes of aggression involving 639 military or political representatives of the Russian Federation. So a year on, there is some data emerging as to the amount that has been assessed by that particular office of international crimes that are being committed in the Ukraine. So it's a huge task to think about how law can cope with war.
Thank you so much, Felicity, for that introduction. Before Charlie comes in with the hard-hitting questions, I was wondering if you would be able to maybe direct our listeners to some resources to better understand the criminal court processes or the terminology that we would be using.
Okay, so keeping it simple, for anybody who's interested in the work of the International Criminal Court, the simplest thing is just to go on the International Criminal Court website. They do have an awful lot of information in there. But I think there's also another useful resource, which, and I would, wouldn't I? I was involved in the production of it, which is the International Criminal Court Mooting Manual that was produced together with the International Bar Association. Now, it's about 10 or 11 years old now, but it's not a traditional mooting manual for lawyers. It actually uses fake case scenarios, sometimes based on real case scenarios, to teach how the International Criminal Court works. So I'm sure you can provide a link to your listeners to this podcast, to that manual. And okay, it's about 10 years old, but it does give you some stories and some processes to try and understand how it works. And I think rather than me give you a long lecture on how does the court work, those are the sorts of resources that will help people to understand.
Well, that moves us really well onto the first question. As you say, now that we've passed the year-long mark of Russia's most recent invasion of Ukraine, reports of war crimes by Russian authorities and armed forces against civilians, as you said, have reached the tens of thousands. These crimes have come in the form of deliberate civilian massacres, the torture and rape of women and children, and other inhumane treatment of captured combatants and civilians. There has been huge international pressure, as I'm sure you know, on the International Criminal Court and the Ukrainian judiciary to prosecute these crimes. However, both institutions have their own jurisdictional and infrastructural restrictions in doing so. Could you explain whether you think these existing institutions have the capacity to handle these cases, particularly in light of the ongoing nature of the Russian invasion? Perhaps you could first address the capacity of the ICC and then move on to the Ukrainian judiciary.
The ICC is really interesting in the sense that, of course, we had this announcement a year ago that the Office of the Prosecutor joined the national authorities in the joint investigation team on the international crimes committed in Ukraine. So there's clearly a commitment, certainly by the Office of the Prosecutor, to get involved in at the investigation stage. And the capacity to investigate at least has a history there. There are people who are experienced in carrying out those types of investigations, in collecting the evidence, in understanding the collection of data and digital material. So I think we have to have some faith in the investigating ability of the International Criminal Court. There are, of course, problems, whichever form of tribunal that might be eventually the one that people come up with. I think we can certainly say that the ICC has the capacity to properly investigate. And there are other questions around which sort of tribunal we should have, or why should it be the ICC, or should it be domestic in Ukraine, or should there be an ad hoc tribunal like we've had in the past. But in terms of your question, the capacity of the ICC to carry out an investigation and then a prosecution, I would say that's what it's there for. I'm there at the minute. I'm defending there. I think that's why we set it up. There may be some specific problems with crimes of aggression and issues that have arisen in Ukraine. And of course, the complementarity will come into play because Ukraine is doing its best to demonstrate that it is willing and able to carry out its own prosecutions, but it needs the assistance of the international community and the assistance of the expertise of the ICC. So it may be that at the moment Ukraine wants to say, well, hang on a minute, we're willing and able to do it ourselves. But yes, in terms of capacity, the ICC is supposed to be capable of doing these things, and Ukraine is saying they are with support. So there's plainly a bit of tension there, but at least there are investigations going on and information is being collected. I would say from a defence perspective, the ICC at least has a history of a defence corner, although that could do with some improvement, in my opinion.
Thank you so much, Felicity. I have a question as a non-law student that's been on my mind for a while. So when it comes to crimes against humanity or war crimes, there are different scales from, let's say, an unwarranted airstrike to, let's say, the rape of a woman on the street. So when it comes to these crimes, which are less massive in scale, but definitely significant, where does it fall under? And who is accountable for ensuring that the justice of these almost silenced voices are brought to light in this case?
So that's a huge question, isn't it? You know, in terms of the sorts of international crimes we're talking about, you've got the context of an armed conflict or a non-international armed conflict. You'll have the need to show that these were widespread and systematic attacks, and then relevant criteria for each type of crime. So the Rome Statute, of course, sets that out for us so that we can understand, those of us who are lawyers, where the evidence that gathered fits. So the idea is that when evidence is gathered, decisions can be made to charge the crime that arises from that evidence. So we hopefully don't have prosecutors charging people with crimes that can't be proved. There ought to be at least sufficient evidence to prove it may transpire that they can't be proved, but there ought to at least be some sufficient evidence to support the charges. And down the line, you have confirmation hearings where the chamber can check the level of evidence and so forth. I think the second half of your question relates to giving a voice to people who have a complaint. So particularly women on the ground who've suffered attacks that involve sexual offending, rape and those types of crimes. And certainly in the case that I'm defending in, there's been a lot of work by NGOs collecting people together, and that may be an issue in itself. But NGOs on the ground do a lot of work. The Office of the Prosecutor has systems for supporting witnesses and victims. Of course, there's also counsel for the victims' groups that provide representation in court and can cross-question witnesses on both sides. So there are systems in place to deal with those people that we consider to be vulnerable witnesses to ensure that they are protected in the way that they give their evidence. And there are meant to be systems in place to ensure that those people can be brought to court safely to give their evidence. And at the same time, of course, again, just dropping in the fact that I'm defending, disclosure to the defence should at least expose when those systems have failed in some way, so that the defence can deal with whether evidence is reliable, credible, properly collected, inconsistent, where there might be issues around that evidence. But the idea is that we do that. We have those protections for witnesses on both sides. You might have a witness for the defence who is equally vulnerable for reasons that we needn't discuss today. We don't want to be too horrific about things. But again, the International Criminal Court has systems for vulnerable people to give their evidence about the situation and about what specifically happened to themselves that they saw, heard, or engaged in.
That was great. Thank you so much, Felicity. So as I'm sure our listeners are aware, following the Second World War, the Allied powers set up an international military tribunal in Nuremberg, specifically to prosecute and punish major Nazi war criminals. And the Nuremberg trials were the first of their kind and paved the way for holding prominent military and political leaders personally criminally accountable for their crimes. In the modern Ukraine context, how successful do you think a Nuremberg-style tribunal for crimes of aggression would be? And would it be more beneficial to focus exclusively on aggression in Ukraine or have a long-standing tribunal set up for all international crimes of aggression?
Yeah, look, I think this is really interesting. And you've got to remember, I'm not a war crimes scholar as such. I've taught some units on it. I'm a practitioner. So I rock up at court and deal with evidential issues, legal issues in particular cases. But there's been some really interesting debates, particularly from Carrie McDougall at Melbourne Law School and Kevin John Heller, who we all know so well, about whether there should be this sort of ad hoc tribunal that deals with the issue of crimes of aggression, whether it should be the International Criminal Court. And I think reading what they have to say about all the positives and negatives and the problems that can arise, particularly in the relation to crimes of aggression, is where your listeners should go to. I don't think it's down to me to summarise those debates. And obviously, ad hoc tribunals have been useful. I think I come down to there are problems, whichever one you choose. I'm quite reluctant to have a tribunal that just deals with one form of crime. I appreciate the crime of aggression is something that we're really keen to see used and implemented and understood. We're trying to move away from war to law. I'm sort of reluctant to say, well, what would you do? You'd have a tribunal that deals with aggression and then you'd have another tribunal that deals with other crimes. Doesn't feel comfortable to me as a practitioner. If you've got a case you want to be dealing with all of the issues in that one case, however hard that might be to manage. And frankly, that's what I do. I manage big cases. I've spent my career kicking open doors that are not meant to be open to me, either as a woman or someone who's from a domestic jurisdiction, or all of those issues we could talk about in another type of podcast. And the thing I really enjoy is managing a big case. And the idea that there might be one case going on in one place and one case going on in another, I would find very uncomfortable as a practitioner. Would disclosure work between the two? Would something fall between the cracks? So from a very practical perspective, I'm not comfortable with a tribunal that just deals with the crime of aggression, even though I appreciate that might be something that the international community is considering. Equally, I'm not necessarily comfortable with a tribunal that just deals with Ukraine, even though we've got that terrible problem at the moment. It's not the only problem in the world. It's not the only place where war crimes are being committed. And post the Second World War, we set up the International Criminal Court for us all to buy into that. I think the problem at the moment is not every state buys into the International Criminal Court. So look, as a practitioner, I like the idea of domestic jurisdictions keeping their jurisdiction where they're willing and able, and the International Criminal Court being supported and funded and able itself to deal with international crimes. And I think that's the framework that we envisaged without all the ad hoc tribunals, even though I recognise that in some circumstances those are necessary. So I'm coming at this from a very practical perspective. I want to go to one place and get it done, whether that's a domestic jurisdiction or the International Criminal Court that is set up to do those things. Now, of course, I recognise that there are problems in both of those scenarios, but that's how I approach it as a practitioner.
No, that makes complete sense. And I think the impracticality of sort of fragmenting the international legal system really does create a whole wealth of problems, even though theoretically it might seem like a lovely idea. But sort of moving on from that, instead of having a wholly international tribunal, I know you said you prefer to keep them separate, but in the context of a hybrid tribunal, in a similar vein to the Bosnian War Crimes Chamber, which famously supplemented the International Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, operating to prosecute lower ranking perpetrators in a hybrid court in which international and national judges serve together. Do you think such a hybrid tribunal could be set up with the Ukrainian judiciary, or would the logistical and impartiality concerns associated with such a tribunal operating in a country in a state of invasion be too unrealistic?
No, I would never say never. The frameworks are really interesting. So my sort of bugbear at the moment is the situation for the defence. So we're, I don't know, 2% of the budget for the ICC. We sit in a corner in part of a building. It's enormous. And the defence are not treated equally to the prosecution. I mean, my daughter made a joke and got a load of pictures of Karim Khan, KC, and photoshopped Felicity Gerry, KC, over his face, shaking hands with people. And, you know, it was a sort of way of our team. I get sent them all to my team in The Hague, and we sort of think this is what equality looks like. That so my problem at the moment is that I think the court seems to be very allied to the prosecution, and that's very visible in the optics. Of course, accountability is really important, but actually the court should be looking a little bit more balanced, in my opinion, and the defence should be given a status equivalent to the prosecution, so that you can have some buy-in around the world. This is going to be a fair process. So with that in mind, that's my bugbear, that you need a tribunal that looks balanced and fair. If there were to be an ad hoc tribunal, I see no reason why that couldn't function with support of the international community. There would be massive security issues. You'd have to make sure that it is balanced and fair. I think you'd have to have monitoring. I think you'd have to really look at what is it about the frameworks at the ICC that are maybe not working that you could improve on. Obviously, the argument is that you could then do crimes of aggression and all the other crimes in that ad hoc tribunal. So that might be sensible. And can you have people that can be there and stay there? I think one of the things in the international courts is they go on for so long that you have a rotation of counsel. Is that a good thing? Should it be people that stay with it? You could argue about that all day, but at least people there long enough to get the cases up and running in a way that would be capable of being assessed and monitored and understood as it goes along. So I think the answer to your question is yes, of course we could. With the right security, with the right methods, with the right monitoring, with the right people, with an understanding of the need to have, for example, cultural awareness, people who are really engaged in getting the process right rather than coming at it from one direction or another, then yes, of course it's possible. Everything is possible. It won't necessarily happen quickly.
No, that's really interesting. And I find it particularly compelling what you're saying about the treatment of the defence in the ICC. During my internship there, I really noticed how the court is really set up for the prosecution and the defence are given such a small area and like you say, only 2% of the budget. It's really quite shocking, especially considering the values and the mission that they, you know, propound. And I was going to ask, previous international tribunals, particularly the ECCC, the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia, and the International Tribunal for Rwanda, have long been the subject of criticism, notably for, as you say, their lengthy case processing times, incredibly high costs to run, and the fact that only a minority of perpetrators do end up facing punishment. With the risk of concluding on a rather bleak note, based on the successes or lack thereof of previous international tribunals, is there hope for Ukrainians in achieving justice?
Oh, look, it's a great question. I'm an optimist, so that I would say there's always hope. I think what's really valuable about the ECCC and other ad hoc tribunals and the ICC is you've got to remember that this is an inquiry into the situation as well as the prosecution of an individual and the defence of an individual. So often you've got a case going on where you're making, the court will make findings about what happened. So that's there forever. Now, it may be that you don't convict many people. And obviously in Cambodia, they were really, really old and a lot of them were dead. But you've got that record for history. The ECCC made those findings. We know what happened, but we know the terrible things and the evidence was collected. And that is so valuable so that we can hope that these things don't happen again. Or if they do, they become fewer and fewer over time. We've got a history of wars and aggression for centuries. Trying to move from war to law is a really huge task for us all as an international community, and we all have to buy into that. So I think there is hope. I think Ukraine is being hopeful about it. Ukraine is saying, well, hang on a minute, we can do it. We've got universal jurisdiction. We can do some of it. We'll talk to you about having a special tribunal because it may be that that becomes necessary, particularly because we're dealing with Russia, which is such a huge monolith in itself. But again, I think I come from that practitioner perspective. You know, a case might be big and enormous and take forever, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. That would say, well, it's all a bit too hard. Let's not bother. And then you don't do what we committed to post the Second World War. You know, for me, it's... if I can tell it in a story way, you know, in the First World War, someone would have sent my son onto a battlefield to die. In the Second World War, someone would have sent my son onto a battlefield to die, you know, and probably now my daughter as well, you know. And so can we get to a world where that doesn't happen? For you people in Ukraine, their families are dying. And so for us to say, well, that's a bit hard, pales into insignificance, doesn't it? When people are dying and there are acts of aggression and international crimes being committed, it's our duty to step up and say, how are we going to do this? Whether that's from a personal perspective or a professional perspective, you've got to give hope to that possibility, haven't you? So I'm ever the optimist. I'm also very practical. I think it's doable. It takes negotiation, good sense, and that sense of balance and fairness. So I'd love to see the defence conversation being had whilst whatever we set up is set up for Ukraine.
Wow. Well, I think that optimism is really invaluable and much needed, I think, in the international criminal justice world. So thank you so much, Felicity, for taking the time to speak to us today. It was really great to get an expert opinion on the subject, and it was great chatting.
You're welcome. I always love to sound off about the things that I like to talk about. So I'm very grateful for having the opportunity. And, you know, optimism can be realistic too, I think, is the message that I'd like to leave.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Felicity. Is there anything else before we end that you'd like to tell other listeners, or if there's anything that we can do as listeners to help support the cause?
Oh, look, I think, again, I'll talk from my perspective. A lot of the work that I've done over the last 2 or 3 years in this type of context is about having women at the table. You know, women in peace and security, I think, is a really important conversation. So in the context of Ukraine, just the same. So if you're researching, if you're scholars and you're looking at the issues around how do we set up these tribunals, how do we make best use of the ICC, how does universal jurisdiction function, what are the processes, procedures, I would always say, where are the women? Where are the women in this conversation? And that's really hard too. It's not easy to sort of kick open the doors in the way that I do. It's not easy to stay there, and it's not easy to be treated equally. So I think that's the other message that I like to bring when I'm doing, whether it's a domestic criminal case or an international criminal case, is just look around a courtroom and say, where are the women? When something's being negotiated, are the women at the table? Are the women's issues being discussed? So that's perhaps the other message that I like to leave, as well as practical optimism, you know, practical reality of having women involved in these types of processes.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, Felicity. And to all of our listeners, thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. For those listening, if you have any questions or comments, please find us on Twitter via at DeclarationsPod, or like us on Facebook. You can also send us an email at editor@declarationspod.com. We would love to hear your thoughts on today's discussion. You can also check out our website at declarationspod.com, where each podcast has a companion piece with more information about each episode and links to additional resources. For more declarations, please subscribe to our Apple Podcast or Spotify, and please do tune in to our next episode. Thank you.